Welcome to Building Better Businesses, an ABA podcast. Learn firsthand from business owners who built successful ABA businesses. Utilize proven techniques and strategies to help your practice thrive. This is Building Better Businesses in ABA podcast with Jonathan Mueller.
Rachel is an M&A advisor and consultant who specializes in small to mid-sized human services companies for Vertes. She has over 25 years of leadership experience as an executive and a business owner. And in fact, she founded and grew over 18 years and sold her human services organization, LifeShare, to a Fortune 500 company in 2015. Rachel, welcome to the pod.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm pumped for our conversation, and I want to hear first, Rachel, before we dive into the M&A work, and tell me about your LifeShare journey as a founder and owner.
Yeah, I have to try to keep it simple. It was a journey for sure. My husband and I were in college and put ourselves through college and got to kind of the end of our experience. And I needed to do my student teaching. And they said, you can't have a job while you are student teaching, which was not going to happen for me. So I became a home care provider for a gentleman who is diagnosed with autism, who happens to be kind of on the more severe end of the spectrum, in that his, you know, diagnosis and labels were of more challenging behaviors. And so that was something they don't teach you in college. It was an experience I was very not prepared for. But I met Ron and got to know Ron, and it was easy to see that these behaviors and these challenges that he was experiencing was because of a lack of understanding and a lack of communication. People weren't building connections with him. They weren't listening to those behaviors. They just were diagnosing it as behavioral. So my husband and I got to know Ron and work through some of these challenges, and figured out that really what he needed was something that wasn't out there. So started LifeShare around Ron's particular needs, which was more of a community-based living and day program. So at the time, you know, all we had were sheltered workshops or kind of day center experiences for Ron. And because of his very early experiences with congregate care being like some school settings, he was pretty defensive around other people. He'd get very easily overstimulated. And so he'd be brought home because of a behavior. And we'd say, well, you know, he doesn't like that setting. You need to provide him with something different. And they just said, well, we don't have that. So LifeShare was started with the intention of never having congregate care. All living was residential living in a shared living environment, no group homes or congregate living situations either. So found that there was a huge need for that, and grew very organically and quickly, all things considered. My husband's very entrepreneurial, so he, you know, really led the charge in that and got us into different states and grew very quickly. So it was a journey all based around really what Ron's needs were. And we ended up living with Ron for just about 10 years. So it was quite a journey.
That's so powerful. And I mean, the fact that you met Ron where he was, and like describing like his environment needed to be changed, right? And that didn't exist, and you created something like that's super special, Rachel. And I in an 18-year journey, and especially as an entrepreneur, and especially in working with individuals with autism and developmental disabilities, there are like lots of ups and downs, I'm sure. So like, what was your hardest moment you had as an owner, and what did you learn from it?
I think as an owner, I think the hardest part, you know, in hindsight, there were tons of challenges and where to begin, right? Especially when you're trying to get into new markets. You know, we worked in an area where my father-in-law was a CEO. So there was issues there. There were lots of things. Mm. But I think in hindsight, what I wish I could do differently or what I learned was we talk about a work-life balance a lot. We don't talk about how entrepreneurs, especially people who really start from the ground up, we have a hard time differentiating from our family to our work family. You know, we love to say that it's our work family. And that's really not very healthy. As much as you want to grow and nurture your staff and be really tight with them, and you want them to invest in your company as much as you do, there are a lot of really hard decisions that need to be made. And I think, you know, when I had to make those decisions, I then internalized them. And so, you know, your sister just quit. Your cousin, you know, isn't doing the job. You know, obviously they're not really sisters and cousins, but it's very hurtful when someone that you thought of as family didn't love you back. You know, they didn't invest the way that you do. So I think I found, you know, as I matured, because we started this in our 20s, in our early 20s, and a lot of our employees were in their 20s and grew up with us. But it was, you know, they'd come to family dinners. We were in their weddings. It became a really difficult transition at one point. And I think it's important to point out to entrepreneurs that it's okay that your work is your work and your family is your family. And there is a healthy line there sometimes. And so now I try to keep them very separate in a good way, so that I don't bring too much home. And I also make sure that my work family is really, you know, they're my colleagues. They're professionals. Mm-hmm. And we all have to make decisions for ourselves.
I think that's a powerful and a hard thing to do as an entrepreneur, to make that jump from, wow, this is everything. And I treat this because it is like my family and my journey and my entire existence.
Yeah. And it's your baby.
That I can have that separation.
Yeah.
Exactly. It is your baby. But the whole idea, it's funny because I've never liked the term work-life balance, especially for entrepreneurs, because balance implies that there has to be a contrast. And I've always thought of it more as like work-life fit. Like this, the sense that you've got to make whatever you choose as your profession, entrepreneur or not, healthcare or not, whoever, you have to choose a profession and a set of things you do in that profession that are consistent and fit with what you want to do in life, and vice versa. So I totally appreciate where you're coming from.
Yeah.
So you, you know.
I was just going to, just playing off that. We all have a different rhythm when it comes to work-life balance.
Yep.
And so, you know, people will say, oh, work-life balance means you can't work on weekends. Well, I'm sorry, but when you're an entrepreneur or a CEO or even a very dedicated employee, sometimes you need to like spend a couple hours on the weekend just to get things off your plate so you can relax. So people's balances are different. And you know, we always like to say we work hard, but we play hard. So we try to make it so that when we do take time off, we try to check out, but we're going to keep checking in. I mean, that's just the reality of it. So right. Yeah, I know what you're saying. Totally. Everybody's different in that way.
Totally. It's almost like, you know, when I do things that are outside of work, even with my kids and my wife or friends or my community, like I actually have to physically pick like activities where I can do nothing but focus on those activities. Like I don't have the, you know, and whatever, like steep skiing where like all of my focus is on getting down to shoot the right way, right? Or like mountain biking and anything else where I can get in my flow state. And that helps me fully separate from work. Whereas if I just go for, not that going for a walk is just going for a walk, or, you know, like it's too easy for my mind.
You're still going there.
Mind especially to wander.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. We have a cabin up in Maine that we bought years ago and we have it because it didn't have internet and it was the only way we could disconnect. But I always joke that my husband would offer to take the garbage to the dumpster because he would get on the main road, download his emails, check in and come back. So yeah, I get that completely.
Oh, I got that. A lot of garbage dumpster trips, I'm sure.
Exactly.
Well, if you fast forward to today, you know, you successfully sold LifeShare, and now for the last number of years, you've been working at Vertesse. But let's start really simple. And Rachel, like, what is a mergers and acquisitions, an M&A advisor, and how's that different from private equity, venture capital.
So your private equity and your venture capitals, they're the buyers. They're ultimately the people who are looking to acquire. An M&A advisor is someone who's going to be that intermediary. So we know who the buyers are, and we know there are lots of buyers. So our buyers are those venture capitalists, those private equity guys, but they're also other people in the field, the strategic buyers. So what we do is work with a seller to find that unique buyer that fits them best. There are some people who want to sell their company and just get top dollar. There are other people who want to find just the right buyer because they are being very cautious with their baby. You know, this is an important transition for them. So an advisor can help you, first of all, understand the value of your company, find that buyer, but then help you from finding that buyer to closing the deal and transitioning, help you through that process. Because it's there are quite a lot of steps in between.
And I've got to imagine that, I mean, that can be, if not a contentious process, some really hard negotiating. So, you know, in your role as an advisor, does that mean that, I mean, and if so, if you know the seller actually sells, like that's gonna be a partnership, right? That lasts for some number of years. And I could see where in that contentious negotiation, that could be, that's hard, right? That might set the future relationship up not to be successful. So is that part of your role as an advisor, is like being the mediator or really having the harder conversations to make sure the relationship preserves?
Absolutely. I tell people all the time, I'll be the bad guy. Make me the bad guy. Because when this is closed, you have to work with this person, whether it's through a transition period or you're going to stay involved. You don't need to be caught up in all of these things. You want on day one, post-close, to be in a partnership with this person. Because again, everybody wants the successful transition and they want this company to be successful after closing. So let me be that person who says, no, no, that's not okay, and put it on me. Absolutely.
Right on. Well, I've gotten to meet, Rachel, so many M&A advisors, and they're all phenomenally smart people and neat. But I have to tell you, like, you're different because you were an owner. Like, you get it. You get this mindset of being an entrepreneur and a founder and owner, and just everything that comes with that, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And in fact, like, to quote Brené Brown, like, you were a gladiator, right? You're in the ring. So how did you decide to get into M&A after you sold LifeShare?
Well, thank you. That's a very kind compliment. I think, you know, it happened to just be through relationships. It was knowing one of the prior owners of Vertes that kind of got me involved. But I really, you know, really what appealed to me was that there were some real missteps in my process. Selling LifeShare was not an easy thing. We did not really have an advisor. You know, it's the idea that, wow, I can really help people with this process. I can do for them what wasn't done for me. And I really do go on that premise. Like, I get it. I get what this is all about, how difficult this process is. And I'm going to help you to understand it and to navigate it in a way that I wasn't able to. So it's a good fit for me.
I mean, what's the most important advice that you would give owners about selling their practice that you wish you had at LifeShare? Is it just that, like, hire an advisor, or what else might be there?
I think it is. One of my favorite things about being an owner, I remember somebody saying, was surround yourself with people smarter than you. And I think this process is very similar. You have to have at the very least, you have to have a really good M&A advisor. M&A lawyer. So in other words, you know, we went to our corporate lawyer and we asked him for help. And he said to us, no, 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 I'm not an M&A person. Here's the guy in my practice who does M&A. And he was absolutely right. But there are a lot of lawyers, as an example, who will say, oh yeah, I'll do this for you. But they don't understand M&A, and that can ruin a deal. That can kill a deal in itself. So I really think having those people around you who understand the process and know the process is paramount. It's number one. And, you know, if you can find a good M&A advisor that you jive with, all the better. Because really, those two people, at the very least, are going to get you more for your company and help you get through it more comfortably than if you don't. Because a lot of things can go south.
What's it like as an ABA owner going through a sale? Like, I'd love for you to sort of paint a picture of the nitty gritty. Like, how long does it take? How do you prepare for it? And how far in advance? What are the surprises you might expect? The emotional roller coaster, like all of those things. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, it's obviously going to depend on the organization, the size, the you know, how many places are billed, you know, how many healthcare organizations are billed for these services, you know, private pay, all that good stuff. But ultimately, the process takes anywhere from 120 days to a couple years. Very unlikely to take a couple of years, but I've got a few that have taken a couple of years. And that's usually because you start off, you know, selling to someone, that buyer it doesn't work out with. So then you find another buyer, or, you know, people pause the process because of things like COVID, which has paused a lot and slowed down a lot of processes. But, you know, ultimately what it comes down to is being upfront and honest with everything. There are no secrets that can be kept in this process. When you go through this process, the first, you know, bulk of it is getting things ready. So what we do is we'll collect 4 years of financials and put together a financial packet that a seller will want to look at in order to understand your finances. Ultimately, everything comes down, when it comes down to purchase price, it all comes down to how much is your revenue and how much is your bottom line? How much are you, what is your net income? And then we do some add backs and create an adjusted EBITDA. But ultimately, and I say that because there are so many wonderful providers who will come to me and say, how much can you sell my company for? And let's say that they're a $5 million in revenue per year organization. And I say, well, based on your, you know, your bottom line, it will probably get a, between $3 and $4 million, you know, and this all comes at, down to the math. And they'll say, but I've done this for 10 years. I put my blood, sweat, and tears into it. It's got to be worth $20 million. I've heard, you know, somebody down the road selling for $30 million. But unfortunately, it really does come down to how much your revenue is and how much money you're making. And we can, you know, help with that bottom line because maybe you're running some personal expenses through your business and such. But ultimately, it comes down to the numbers. So I've had a lot of people come to me. We do one of those free assessments for them where we'll look at their financials and tell them what we think the market will pay for their company. And they'll say, I need more than that to retire. So we'll say, okay, well, here's some things you can do. Here's how you can get there. Go back, work on it, and let's talk in another year and see if you're closer to that target. And then, you know, ultimately, once they get to that point, we do that financial analysis for our buyers. We put together our marketing materials for our buyers. That takes about 90 days, well, 60 to 90 days, getting that information from the sellers and such. Go to market. That takes, you know, finding the buyers and negotiating with them takes between 60 to 120 days to get kind of under that LOI. Again, varies by the speed of the buyer and the seller. But then once you have an offer, the hardest part really is the due diligence, which is you have your offer, you all agree what it's going to look like. Now as a seller, you have to open the curtain and you have to share everything about your organization, from pending lawsuits and litigations to employee issues, to pay rates, to your billing rates, and how quickly you're getting your payments. So the buyer looks under the hood to make sure that everything that we have represented is true. That's what takes the most amount of time. That's what taxes the seller the most, because just when you think you've given every piece of paper that's passed your desk, they will ask for something more. Leases, they will ask for, your contracts with your payers, your contracts with your subcontractors. You know, they will look at everything. And that's the hardest part, because you do feel like you're being scrutinized. No matter how great you are, you kind of feel like someone's not trusting you and they're asking you to prove it. So that's the hardest part for a seller. And then once, you know, once that's done, the purchase agreement gets negotiated, a good M&A lawyer is where that comes in. And then, you know, and then you close the deal. So it's a lot of work. And the pace depends very much on the seller and how quickly they can get this work done.
Mm. What are the protections in place for a seller, you know, who has turned away now all these other suitors, right? These other potential buyers signed a letter of intent to sell. And then now you've embarked on this multi-month process of diligence. It seems like it'd be pretty easy for a buyer to say, let's give you a haircut on this for XYZ, whatever reasons. Like, what are the protections in place?
Well, again, that's why you want people who know this business in your corner, because that's very much what happens. There are definitely those buyers that's their MO. That's what they do. And we've seen it and we know it. And oftentimes we can warn you on that. You know, sometimes what we'll try to do is get multiple offers, put them side by side and say, okay, I've worked with this company. They will try to beat you up on price. But ultimately, that final price is based on financials. And if they're going to give you a haircut and try to say, listen, I know we offered 5, but now we're going to give you 4. If they're going to do that, they've got to prove to you where they came up with that. And if you have a good advisor or good representation on your side, you can say, oh, no. That's not the case. This, you know, these are the numbers. You said you'd give us a 5x multiple on our adjusted EBITDA. We disagree with your calculations on that adjusted EBITDA. And that's where that negotiation can happen. Does it still happen sometimes? Absolutely. And whether, you know, sometimes you're prepared for it. So you kind of know and you go in ready. And then you're willing to take that cut because you knew they overpromised, which is sometimes the case. Other times, that worst case scenario, you know, there's two kind of pieces there. First of all, once the buyer gets to that point, they don't want this deal to fall through either, because they have paid due diligence teams to do all of this analysis. They've invested money and time as well. So it's very infrequent that a buyer will just walk away, just say, forget it. I'm not going to do this if you don't agree with me. They'll usually negotiate with you. They don't want the deal to fail at this point. But if it does fail, which it sometimes does, what we do is we go back to those 3 other offers that we had and say, hey, guess what? That deal fell through. Will you still honor your offer? And they'll usually say, why did it fall through? And we'll say exactly what it is, because if there was an issue, they're going to find it as well. But we'll say this was their issue. We still expect what we expect. Oh, and P.S., we manage the data room. So all of that information that was uploaded for that prior buyer is still in our vault. So we just flip, you know, who gets access, and we start where we left off. So we don't have, you know, that seller doesn't have to start that all over again. So, you know, it does happen. And it's being prepared for whatever scenario that is.
And to clarify a term, EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, it's a way essentially of looking at profitability and what's common, as you referenced, multiples of EBITDA. So if your operating income, your profitability is $1 million, say a year, and you get 1x EBITDA, you would get paid $1 million. 2x would be 2 million, 5x EBITDA, 5 million, et cetera. What are the multiples that you're seeing in the autism services ABA space?
That is such a loaded question right now. I am a firm believer of under promising and over delivering. And in my opinion, you know, the industry standard is between, you know, 4 and 7 times adjusted EBITDA to your earlier definition. But in the ABA space, there has been a huge interest, specifically from financial investors. So the private equity folks, which, you know, your whole field is seeing right now, really likes the space of ABA. They see it as scalable. They see it as a lot less risk than maybe just, you know, than maybe an IDD provider who is in charge of someone's lives 24/7. You know, with ABA services, it's a clinical setting, a little less risk. So there are multiple reasons that, you know, the industries are excited about it. But we have seen multiples between 9 and 13 and sometimes higher. I've heard about it. I haven't seen it, but it's usually an ABA provider who has revenue north of, let's say, 7 million. So if you have about 25 million in revenue with maybe at least a 10% bottom line, so you're making a very healthy profit. Those are the companies that are trading at those higher multiples. I always hesitate to say those higher multiples because I get calls from people with $1 million in revenue or $3 million of revenue or $5 million of revenue. And they're hearing some of these other businesses trading at these incredible multiples. And I won't ever promise that. I've actually lost business because I had someone say, tell me you'll get me a 12X. And I said, I won't promise you that. I'll try for it because we don't set a price. We put your company out there with the financials and then we ask the buyers to bid on your organization. Oftentimes that drives up multiple all by itself. And it does. But, you know, I'm not going to promise you a 12X. Will you probably see it? Yeah. Yeah, it's very likely. But I would much rather tell you to expect a 7 or an 8. And then you're pleasantly surprised with a 12 or a 13. That would make us all very happy. So,
and to be, the higher the multiple, the higher the multiple and the more a buyer pays, then the higher the expectations after the sale, I would imagine, right? Because you've got to grow into how they valued it.
Usually, I mean, and again, it depends on the structure of the deal. And that's another thing other people don't talk about. They might say that they got a 13X or a 15X, but that might mean, to your point, that they only got maybe a 6X at closing, if you really break it down, but they had an earnout, which means that if they, to your point, reach those certain benchmarks in year one and year two, then they will get an additional payment on what they've earned. And that's often, it's a great way, an incentive for a buyer to ensure that this company post-close continues to be successful and grow. There are all sorts of ways that can be difficult. And they build those things in for sure.
A thread that I want to tease out here is just that difference in like a provider that commands like a 5X versus a 12, 13X, and less so like financially, whatever that, you know, put that off to the side, but more just like, what does it take to create this business that someone's going to value that much more? And so one thing I heard you describe earlier was size, and there's a premium that comes with size, presumably because, safer, you know, but what are the other things that go into a higher valuation business? What makes a great business?
I think the only second thing really is diversification. So from the initial take, it's size and diversification. So how big you are, but also how many, do you have multiple payers? If you're billing Medicare or Medicaid, and private insurance. So are you billing Blue Cross Blue Shield? Are you billing the regional centers or, you know, the area agencies in your state? But also the third and the one I think we all think most about, and that really is most important, is the quality of your services. Do you have a good reputation? Mm-hmm. Are you free of litigation? Your growth pattern will demonstrate that. So you can talk all day long mm-hmm. about how great your services are, but you also need to be able to back that up. What do you have to prove that you have the best services in the state or in your area? One mm-hmm. will be repeat business. That's all great. And growth will also be very helpful mm-hmm. there. But if you really want to get savvy, you are collecting some of that data now. So are you doing surveys during services, after services, you know, those exit interviews? Are you doing surveys from your referral sources? Are they, you know, are they happy with the services you're providing? Are you demonstrating through data how quickly a child can go from this, you know, baseline to growth? All of those outcome mm-hmm. measurements are really very helpful in demonstrating the quality of your services. You know, because it's easy to say you guys are great. It's hard to show it. So the more that you can demonstrate mm-hmm. it through data, the better.
ABA practice owners, are billing and insurance issues getting you down? Well, let me tell you, Element RCM is your answer. Element provides world-class revenue cycle management services, contracting, credentialing, authorizations, billing, and more. Element's your partner, so you can focus on what you love to do, providing the highest quality services to your families and clients. Element's a preferred partner of the Behavioral Health Center of Excellence, and its founders have nearly 20 years of experience owning and operating successful ABA organizations. They understand you. They know that every dollar counts, that integrity is everything. Element works with any practice management system, and Element's not a vendor, they're your partner. So find out more and take a free revenue cycle assessment at elementrcm.ai. Yeah, service diversification is important for so many different reasons. But it's, you know, Element RCM, where, you know, one of my two organizations, we will sometimes work with organizations that, like, they're only providing services to, say, TRICARE or yep. or wherever. But when you've got one funding source, you're exposed potentially to unilateral rate cuts, which we see in our field. Yeah. You're exposed to maybe like huge changes in clinical service provision terms or, clinician requirements, right? Like all kinds of things that I think that's sage advice, like really keep close eye out on payer source diversification to minimize some of those risks.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's important to note too that and I try to tell this to a lot of my smaller businesses that I talk to and I might consult with. Buyers are buying because they know they're not entrepreneurial and they don't want to put in the time. You know, the reason they're buying is because you're good at what you do. They're not. You know, they want to step into your shoes and take over. So the more opportunities for growth you give them, the more desirable your company is. That's the diversity in funding. You might not ever bill Blue Cross Blue Shield, but if you're approved to bill, that then gives that buyer an opportunity to maybe provide other services. Maybe they bring in some OTs and PTs and speech pathologists, or, you know, they're going to look at what they're capable of billing a private insurance company. And then they're going to say, wow, there's some opportunities for us to diversify the funding ourselves. So even if you are in that space where there's only one payer, because it all goes through the state, you know, the state funding, what else could you do? And even if you don't do it, just providing the opportunity is a big deal.
Now, you mentioned earlier that COVID has slowed down some of the deal activity. Is that due to, you know, not being able to fly as much? Is it due to, so many ABA providers, it's been hard, right, the last 2 years struggling through. But what's driven that?
Ultimately, I think it's fear. It's fear on both sides. Mm-hmm. So the very first slowdown was when we were all locked down and nobody knew what the markets were going to do. Nobody knew if we were ever going to leave our houses. Nobody knew if ABA services would be back up and going. Now, any of us know, of course it's going to. This need is never going to go away. And I think one of the things that COVID taught a lot of investors is that healthcare and human services is recession proof. It's always going to be needed. So we're always going to need these services. How we deliver them is going to need to evolve and change. And thank goodness for that. I think this also lit a fire under some of the changes we all know we needed to see to provide and reach more people. Now I think the biggest hurdle is that, you know, if you gave me your financials for the last 3 years, and again, the purchase price is based on those financials, you probably had a dip in billing at some point. And we need to be able to talk about that. And you probably not only had a dip in revenue, you also probably paid some people overtime to cover for sick employees or a lot of people who left because they decided to stay home with their families. And, you know, there has been a major shift in service delivery, and a lot of ABA providers have felt that hit. Their financials don't look as good as they did in 2019. They've been on a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we work really closely to help really identify what are the COVID effects of these financials and what's going to happen in the next 3 years as we recover from this, and how can we ensure you get the value of your organization by stripping out all of this COVID stuff. And it's a dance because the buyers certainly don't want to give you credit for that. They want to just buy you at your worst and get a bargain. But it's our job to make sure that we really help to identify the real performance of this company, regardless of how COVID has made an impact.
That's insightful. Well, tell me about the, you've represented so many ABA providers as sellers. Tell me about the most successful outcome and transaction you've had and the least successful. And what have you learned from that?
I think my favorite was that I got to represent a competitor of mine from New England. And we were friendly competitors, obviously, but he had, a large part of the market share, as did we. And a few years ago, he decided he was going to sell, and I got to sell his company. And so he, just to be clear, he wasn't a pure ABA provider. He was a provider of residential and day services for the IDD population, but it was all encompassing regardless. And we spent a good year and a half to 2 years on his deal, primarily because he wanted to meet and interview every buyer. He only wanted to bring his organization to a select few buyers. He wanted them to be strategic, not financial. And he just wanted to find the best situation for his company. So he handpicked the buyers based on who I knew was kind of in the same ballpark as him. And he ended up selling his organization to Mosaic, which is a very large nonprofit organization that is national. And what came of that was Mosaic's now renewed interest in providing more and more community-based care. And from someone who is very passionate about community-based care and trying to get more away from congregate care, it really did my heart good to see that these two companies came together and learned from one another. And that's really what our seller wanted. So that was probably my happiest story. And this, Neil became an even better friend, and we stay in touch. And it was just kind of a nice happy ending. The worst was another provider who said, I have to sell now. And I said, okay, let's get this stuff going. And we had offers on the table. We were in the middle of choosing an offer, and I suddenly got a call that the state had come in and removed the individuals from his care, from his homes. And I said, well, what happened there? They don't just come in and move people. That's not right. Well, a shutoff notice was put on all of the homes because he had not paid the bills. He was being foreclosed on his properties. Lesson to be told that you have to be open and honest about this process. Had I known that, we could have sold the real estate to a company like CapGrow, which is a real estate investor. Mm-hmm. There are companies out there that will buy your properties and lease them back to you so you can liquidate, you know, some holdings. You can take your money out of the real estate, put it back in your business, and then we could have sold the business. But he wasn't truthful with me about the state of his organization. He thought he could just kind of rush it and not tell me. So now I always start off talking to people and saying, just tell me what the deal is, because I can handle stuff now. But if I have to fix it after the fact, now we're backpedaling and a lot of bad things can happen. So, you know, that's where the relationship is so very important. So,
yeah, I mean, it sounds like so many lessons to be learned there, but what I heard is like, be as intentional and future looking as you can when it comes to thinking about a sale, so that you can do the things to get your organization in the right shape. And if you can't do that, just disclose and be truthful, right, so you're not eroding trust of the seller.
Because nobody's
I love
perfect.
How you describe that.
Yeah.
Totally. But yeah, that idea that like one and one makes three with the, you know, your former competitor who sold the Mosaic and now they've carried on and expanded those services. That's powerful, Rachel.
That's neat.
What's, you know, if you could wave your magic wand and change just one thing about the role that, you know, private equity, venture capital plays in healthcare, what would you do?
I guess I'd have to start by saying, you know, there, private equity is a very broad category. And when I came into this position, to me, because of my prior life, they were kind of the big bad money people. And since I've been in this role, I have definitely met some really nice people in the private equity space who are genuinely in it for the right reasons. So my magic wand would be everybody's in it for the right reasons. Because there are some people who are just in it to make money. And that's what I don't love. But realistically, everybody in business is in business to make money. Because even if you're, and I try to have this really fierce conversation with a lot of people that I advise, I know that your life's mission is to help these kiddos and do great things. And that is so admirable and important. But as an entrepreneur, if you are not making money, if you are not running your finances appropriately and preparing for a rainy day, AKA COVID or rate cuts or whatever could come down, then you can't continue with your mission. There is no mission without the money, unfortunately. And even a nonprofit has to raise that money to provide those wonderful services. So we have to be mindful that to accomplish our mission of changing the world, which some of us want to do, you know, it's not just making money, it's really, really helping people. We have to be really mindful about the finances and we have to be smart with them. There are some private equity folks who want to get in to a company that is changing the world. And they do want to take their money that they've raised and they want to invest it in something that is going to make a difference. And I have met some people like that and I love working with them. And I, my, and the only other thing that I would wish is that those other folks who call me and ask me about some of these services have a better understanding of the services. There's nothing that burns me more than someone calling me and saying, "Oh, I see you have this IDD company, you know, how many beds, how many lives?" And I'm like, they're not beds. They're not lives. These are people. They're not patients. They're not sick. Get your lingo in order, understand who you're supporting. There's certain words you don't use, please don't. I've called people out on that as well. Know your audience, know what this is about. And I get it. You want to make a profit. I understand that. And that's what, you know, drives certain things. Know what you're getting into, you know, I think that, you know, LifeShare, is not, thriving right now, because our buyer did not understand that the bottom line, would not be in LTSS. You know, you're not going to make a profit on long-term services. Mm. Now, their opportunity, we felt, was looking at the whole person. Let's really look at the fact that people in our services, you know, get their services through, you know, this LTSS organization, mm-hmm. which is fine. But when they have medical needs, they go to the ER. When they have a panic attack, they go to the ER. Mm-hmm. You know, people weren't being looked at as whole people, and there were lots of Band-Aids in place. So let's look at the whole person. Mm-hmm. And really help these insurance companies, these managed care companies, treat people in these services appropriately. I don't know. That's a soapbox.
Amen. Amen. Yeah. Amen. Let me add another word to that I hate hearing is customer lifetime value. It's like, dude, that's for fucking technology product or company. That's not for a child with autism. It's, yeah.
Oh, but you make a great point.
Right? Like, there's... Oh yeah. We won't go all the way down that road right now, but just like anything in life, like private equity, like you mentioned, Rachel, is this big umbrella and you have all types out there, and maybe we don't have magic wands to change everyone to be sort of have that passion and values alignment for the kids we serve that we do. But what we can do if we're considering selling our practice, if I'm hearing you right, is just put the time in to get to know, your potential buyer. And ensure there's values alignment. Ensure that you're on the same page with the direction of the business. Ensure that they are taking, you know, the work that you're doing, the meaningful impact you're having on the world as seriously as you are. And it sounds like that's something that is in a seller's control.
And that's one of the reasons it's important to have an advisor who kind of knows kind of what you need. In that, and again, not trying to sell myself here, but one of the things that I try to empower all of my sellers to understand is, yeah, I'm trying to find them a buyer, but they're looking for a buyer too. So as these buyers are coming in and doing their diligence, you as a seller should do your diligence too. Is this someone you want to sell your company to? You can say no. It might be the highest offer you get, but if you're not feeling it, if the vibe is not there, then don't sell to that person. You don't have to. And I mean, mm-hmm. I've had conversations with certain buyers that I've just turned to the seller and been like, "That guy was yucky. I don't know if you want to talk to him." Mm-hmm. And I might be shooting myself in the foot, but I have to be upfront with these people, you know, like, okay. And I'll say to somebody, "Okay, I don't really care for this guy, but he puts in the highest bids. So you might want to talk to him because, you know, it might help you understand how high the bids can go. But ultimately, if you don't like him, we won't take his offer." You know, it's you.
I like that. The yucky factor. That's the sniff test. Absolutely. You know, or just be a good human being. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Do your homework. It's the same thing. If you do a job interview and you're interviewing, you know, a potential employee and they have never looked at your website and they don't even know the name of the company, you're probably not going to hire them. Mm. You know, you want someone invested in working for you. And it's the same thing. If you have a buyer,
yeah.
they should know a lot about your company. They should have looked at your website. They should have done their homework. You know, if they don't know some of the simple stuff, then maybe that's not the direction you want to go.
Yeah. Oh gosh, you struck a nerve there too. So can I tell you my biggest pet peeve when interviewing prospective team members for Ascend or for Element is when they don't have any questions for me.
Yeah.
It's like, if you did enough research, you realize there's a lot of really interesting stuff, but there's probably a lot of other open questions you have. Like, do your research and bring that to me, and like, and let's have a conversation around it. So you struck that nerve. What's something, Rachel, that you'd encourage every ABA owner to start doing and one thing to stop doing?
I think start really understanding your P&Ls. I think the reality is again, as entrepreneurs, and I'm stereotyping here, most ABA owners usually started out as a clinician. They come into this space because they started providing therapies. They grew because they're so good at what they do. And suddenly they've got this $5 million organization. And what we tend to do, and I'm guilty of this, and this is why I'm saying, or I was guilty of it. I used to get the financials at the end of every month. And all I would do is I would kind of look through to see if there were any anomalies. But ultimately, I'd go to the bottom. Is the bottom number in the red or the black? If it was in the red, that was my oh shit moment. How are we going to cover payroll, or how are we going to, you know, this is not a good thing. If it was in the black, that meant we paid the bills. We, you know, payroll's all set. We're good. We made, you know, we're not losing money. Awesome. And that was as far as I took it. And now that I'm in this position, I understand that, again, you have to not only be in the black, but you should be trying to shoot for at least a 10% bottom line, because that is your safety net. That is how you're going to ensure that if you do suddenly lose a contract, or all of a sudden the billing rates get chewed up, or you have to hire a full-time BCBA in order to get that additional business, you have that flexibility to invest in your growth. But if you're just constantly chasing your tail with your financials, that doesn't set you up for future success, whether that be an exit or whether that be a catastrophic moment like COVID. There were a lot of really wonderful providers who closed their doors during COVID because they could not afford to maintain you know, what they had going on, whether they were too small, they didn't have the resources to get the, you know, any stimulus money, whatever. And we, you know, a lot of people were only surviving because they got the stimulus money. So it's really important to know your financials, just as important as knowing your clinical records. Like, you guys, you know, you'll, again, as a clinician, you look at that progress of that kiddo. Are we, you know, are we making strides? Are we meeting our goals? And that shows the quality of your business. And that's really super important. But again, if you can't pay your staff, you can't keep going.
Yeah. Cool. So that's one thing to start doing. Sage advice: get to know your P&L, your profit and loss statement.
Yeah.
That's one thing to stop doing.
Stop throwing people at problems. I do a lot of consulting of business owners as well. And I'm, again, guilty of this as well. It's so easy when you sit down with your teams and you problem solve, any issues in your organization. And, you know, ultimately, when you say to your teams, well, how can we fix this? We need a new admin, or we need a new, you know, if we had one more person, we could fix this problem. And a lot of times it's that whole idea of let's not work harder, let's work smarter. And people's, you know, people running businesses tend to think that if we just hire one more person, our problems are going to be solved. And that often is not the solution. Let's figure out how to use technology. You know, let's figure out how to streamline processes. Are we using three pieces of paper instead of one? You know, are we using the same redundant forms? Mm. How can we, you know, there are so many ways to work smarter, not hire more people.
Is it in software development? There's like a Brooks Law or something that speaks exactly to that. And it's this observation that actually throwing more people at a late software project actually delays it that much more. It's for like the reasons that you describe. It's like if you take the time to ask five whys and root cause and like do the critical thinking of how you want to solve that problem as opposed to just hire someone and put them on it. Throw one question at me, Rachel, anything, and make me answer on the spot.
What's your end goal? What's your exit plan? Because I'll preface by saying, you don't know that your kids are going to want to inherit your business. Like we all kind of think like, oh, well, you know, maybe my kid will, or a family member will take it over. There's, you know, what is your goal for the next phase of Ascent, you know, or Elements, you know, like where do you see it?
You know, when you first ask the question, like, what's your goal? Like the first thing that came to my head is like, I want my three kids to be like happy, healthy, and feeling like they can have fun in life. And so that's where I first went to. Very candidly for Ascent, like we haven't, my business partner and I like haven't had any thoughts about selling or exiting. But your point is a really important one. Is like, ultimately, what is your goal, right? Because my guess is, I don't know, if I live another 50 years, am I still going to be, I don't know. And there's this Chinese expression that says like from rice paddy to rice paddy in three generations, meaning that even passing down your business, right, to kids, maybe goes right for that generation, the next generation goes terrible. But coming back, like what's the goal for Ascent then separate from some kind of financial transaction? You know, we over the next 5 years want to get to serving 1,000 kids a year. We want to be the leading early intervention provider in the Mountain West region. When people think about ABA and highest quality treatment for young kiddos, Ascent is the beacon on the hill. And I think, and so there's a lot of important reasons to want to grow, not the least of which is we see rapid consolidation in our field, right? People, small providers are getting gobbled up for better, for worse. And we know that consolidation in healthcare ultimately leads to higher prices for consumers. It can erode quality. And so we want to show that like we can grow, clinical quality will improve, culture will strengthen. Those are like our three non-negotiables. We're going to make that happen. Size gives us a seat at the table with payers. It gives us a seat at the table with referral sources. And that's it puts us more in control of our fate. And, oh, by the way, like one of the most important things I think about is how do I give back to the world? And one way that we can do that at Ascent, there are many ways we do it, certainly serving kids directly, but you know, we want to grow the next generation of behavior analysts, RBTs, that are practicing at the absolute highest quality of services. And we have conviction that, you know, the training and the support and the things that we do actually make that happen. So we want to prove that out because it feels like then we're giving back to our field, not just to our families and our team members.
That's awesome. Because the reality is no matter how much consolidation is happening, doesn't mean there's not room for quality providers. So sure, if other people are gobbling up other companies, it doesn't mean, you know, that there's not a demand for quality services, and that will always win out. Especially when parents are making the decisions, you know, they're deciding where their kiddo's going to go, and you know, they're going to look for that quality and that word of mouth. And I think, you know, I think you hit on an important point. There really should be goals for every provider, long-term goals. And it can be, we want to be the best of the best. But setting a goal helps you kind of take some steps towards it. And I think that's really useful for any entrepreneur and, you know, and their teams. So I'm a huge fan of that.
The power of goal setting. Well, Rachel, where can people, listeners, find you, you and Vertes, on social media and online?
Yeah, we're at vertess.com, V-E-R-T-E-S-S.com. And we've got from that website, there's also, we have a website called Salient Values, where we've all contributed some articles about M&A, experiences, values. They're more anecdotal, and they're kind of helpful to peruse through if you're thinking about it or planning ahead for it. That's all there, free, no obligation, easy to check out as well.
Awesome. Right on. Thank you for providing those free resources. And we'll put a link in the episode notes. So are you ready for the hot take questions?
All right. Bring it all on. Right.
You're on your deathbed, Rachel. What's the one thing you want to be remembered for?
Honesty. Yeah, it's got to be honesty. And I think honesty translates easily to, like, I honestly and genuinely love the people in my life. They know who they are. Mm. They feel it. You know, so just that pure honesty. As weird as that sounds. Mm.
No, not weird at all. What's your most important self-care practice?
Time with my family. I have two adult kids, 22 and 23. So they're out of the house. Mm-hmm. So any opportunity to spend time with them, with my husband, is a gift. So just went to Target mm-hmm. with my daughter just as an excuse to spend time with her. So all about it.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Well, if you could cancel all your meetings and play hooky for a day, how would you spend the day?
Oh, with them. That's it. You know, again, going to Target with my daughter, you know, like sitting outside and reading with my husband, just chilling out. Just all about family, even, you know, my nephews and my nieces and my sisters and my brother. Yeah. My father-in-law and my parents, my, you know, their families, all that.
Awesome. Well, what's your favorite Madonna song?
You know, it's got to be Holiday. And the reason being is my son just texted it to me last week, literally just out of nowhere, like sent me the song. And then he said, it's that kind of a day. And I was like, now that's a vibe right there. Like, I just thought that was pretty cool. Yeah.
So Gen Z actually knows Madonna. Is this true?
My kid does. My kid, yeah. I will send him random 80s songs and he'll get into it. Like, all of a sudden he'll get in the car and he'll put on like his playlist and it'll have like SWV and like, oh my gosh, Go West. These are all like random 80s groups that are a little more not as popular, but oh yeah, he'll play all my favorites. It's so fun. Yeah.
80s, one of the greatest decades of all time, hands down. What's so if you could give your 18-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Not to let others have any more power over you than you give them. Or the quote, it's something like, people only have as much power over you as you give them. And, you know, my 18-year-old self allowed others to define my worth and my value and my strengths. And through maturity, I've learned that they were wrong. You know, I know better now. And I am the kind of person that if you don't like me, it cuts me to my soul. So I internalize that and I need to not do that. And so I have really tried to empower that in my kids as well. And I often coach people on that as well. Like, you need to be, you know, very honest and open and, you know, do the best you can. And if you did the best you can, don't feel badly about it. You can't let somebody kind of take your power. And that's important.
I have goosebumps. Such good life advice.
Well, it's been a lesson for me. It's big. Yeah.
Well, if you could only wear one style of footwear for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Berks. I'm in them 50% of my life anyway. My kids joke that we were wearing Berks. My husband and I have been wearing Berks. When I met my husband 26, 27 years ago, he was wearing Berks and and wool socks in the winter in New Hampshire. And we've never stopped wearing them. And so my kids joked that when they were popular, they were like, my parents liked them before they were popular. Yeah, I don't believe in uncomfortable feet. It's all about Birks.
Yes. Yes. And life is way too short for uncomfortable feet. And yes, my Birkenstocks that lasted me from like 93 to, I don't know, 98, still one of my all time favorite shoes.
Yeah. Yeah.
They got stinky, but they were functional and comfy.
They're always. Exactly.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it. I love chatting with you. It's way easier than just, recording stuff or talking at somebody. So it's great. Great to chat with you.
Thanks for listening to Building Better Businesses in ABA podcast. Stay tuned for our next exciting episode. In the meantime, please like, subscribe, share, and comment. We value your feedback. Don't forget to follow us on social media at elementrcm.ai.